Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm in hour 23 of a Claritin D, so I may crash during about the middle of this program. But right now, I'm raring to go. The chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, yeah, got to be a smart guy, right? Was on one of the Sunday Yak shows today and he was asked by David Gregory. Apparently, there are rumors flying around about David Gregory's continuation of tenure as host of Meet the Press. Anyway, he was asked by David Gregory about a statement that he'd made a couple of weeks ago, the head of the House Intelligence Committee, averring to his belief that Edward Snowden, the former NSA contractor who has released all these, under whose auspices all these NSA documents have been released, that Snowden was a tool of the Russians. And Gregory, perhaps emboldened by the rumors regarding his imminent demise, said, well, don't you think you were going a little too far in saying that without any evidence at all to back it up? And Rogers said, well, you know, I talk to the intelligence people and I know what they know. And then House Intelligence Committee Chairman Rogers said this.
So here's what we know, David. We know today no counterintelligence official in the United States does not believe that Mr. Snowden, the NSA contractor, is not under the influence of Russian intelligence services.
So that's what we know. We know that the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee used a triple negative on us. He did a 390. I don't know what he did. Here it is again.
So here's what we know, David. We know today no counterintelligence official in the United States does not believe that Mr. Snowden, the NSA contractor, is not under the influence of Russian intelligence services.
Okay. Can you figure it out? What is he saying? You got to be a smart guy to be head of the House Intelligence Committee, I guess. Got to be smarter than us. He also did, Mike Rogers, in talking about Ukraine, as he called it, Ukraine. Maybe he heard the song last week. He said why this is so important, why we should care, why we should get involved, why we should have stronger reaction to it. He said that someone that he knew or that he was aware of was apparently tortured by someone else who may, his word, be Russian in an attempt to get a confession that the Americans were behind the uprising in Kiev, which eventuated in the toppling of the previous Ukrainian government. And he said, these are the kind of people we're up against. Yeah, not the kind of people who waterboard to get the information, people who torture in other ways. Speaking of which, the Obama administration, most transparent in history, more often than ever censored government files or outright denied access to them last year under the Freedom of Information Act. This is according to an analysis by the Associated Press. The administration cited more legal exceptions it said justified withholding materials and refused a record number of times to turn over files quickly that might be especially newsworthy. Most agencies also took longer to answer records requests. The government's own figures from 99 federal agencies. Where's that other one? Covering 6 years shows that halfway through its second term, the administration has made few meaningful improvements in the way it releases records, despite its promises from day one. Was it day one? God, seems like day two, doesn't it? To become the most transparent administration in history. In category after category, the government's efforts to be more open about its activities last year were their worst since President Obama took office. 3 years after Obama, 5 years after Obama directed agencies to less frequently invoke a deliberative process exception to withhold materials describing decision making, the government did it anyway, a record 81,000 times. This is in addition to the 9,000 pages of documents that the Obama administration withheld, took back from the Senate Intelligence Committee, which was investigating, oh my God! Torturing people to, enhancing their interrogation to find out, to make them say, that the United States was running. No, to other things. What other, we needed to find out other things. And also on the subject of secrecy, executives of several large U.S. internet companies, including Facebook and Google, met the president this week, just a couple days ago, to discuss their concerns over government surveillance programs. Yes, they care, because they're losing money. Companies in other and governments in other countries don't want to do business with them. Obama and senior aides met the six tech executives to discuss issues surrounding intelligence, technology, and privacy. Eric Schmidt and Mark Zuckerberg, you got to trust them. Also, Reed Hastings, head of Netflix. The president sought to reassure them that the administration is putting in place reforms to intelligence collection. Facebook's Zuckerberg, a public critic of government data gathering practices, yeah, he wants it, said that more needed to be done. And now we've learned that the NSA, I think we learned this week, the NSA doesn't have to depend on metadata alone. It can just record up to 30 days, record and hold up to 30 days of actual phone calls, not metadata about the calls, the content itself. Obama has asked Attorney General Holder and the U.S. intelligence community to report back to him before a March 28th deadline on how to preserve the necessary capabilities of the metadata program without the government holding the metadata. Here, you hold it. Any hands? Some of the largest U.S. technology companies, including Google, Yahoo, Twitter, and others, have been pushing for more transparency, oversight, and restrictions to U.S. government intelligence gathering. You know what, ladies and gentlemen? I'm going to bet that they don't get very much in the way of satisfaction about that. But I'll bet that the tax loopholes allowing them to pay a lot less taxes by holding their money overseas, those are going to stay in place. What do you think? Hello, welcome to the show.
They gave me a test to make me the best that I could be. They knew all along that there was something wrong with me. We picked out a spot and made a hole. Wire and glass and stainless steel. Now I can imagine how I feel.
Got a new heart, I got a new heart.
There's blood on the bed, but here in my head, I'm feeling fine. It's easy to sleep when I'm not buzzing all the time. So funny the way I was before. Once I was blind, but now I see. Once I was him, but now he's me.
From the banks of Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show, ladies and gentlemen. And now news of
AFA.
I gave you time to turn your volume down in case you minded that. Uncontrolled corruption in Afghanistan could cost the United States what fragile progress it has made in the most expensive reconstruction of another country it has ever attempted. That's according to the SIGTARP, the Special Inspector General for... No, not the SIGTARP, the CIGAR for Afghanistan Reconstruction. The $102 billion U.S. has spent on Afghan reconstruction and security has bought little of either, he says, and rampant corruption may be the spoiler for U.S. hopes of a stable Afghan state. That's according to John Sopko, the CIGAR. Or just reality. Speaking this week, Sopko offered a blunt account of waste through unplanned and unmonitored spending. The costs in Afghanistan, both in lives lost and money spent, have been enormous. He said if we don't get serious about corruption right now, we're putting all of the fragile gains we've achieved in this, our longest war, at risk of failure. Unquote. Any bets? Afghan political problems and the weakness of its state structures have created much of the breeding ground for corruption. Transparency International measures Afghanistan as the most corrupt nation in the world, along with Somalia and North Korea. We're not number one. But U.S. policies themselves also built this problem, according to the CIGAR. U.S. strategy of paying and arming local warlords to seize the country from the Taliban in the first place and then to rule it under U.S. protection let many of them create criminal networks. What do you know? Involved in everything from extrajudicial land seizures and extortion to narcotics trafficking and money laundering. Like they think they're HSBC or something. Then, quote, massive military and aid spending overwhelmed the Afghan government's ability to absorb the assistance, he said, and coupled with weak oversight, created opportunities for corruption. We opened the spigots and let the cash flow, unquote, the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction. He insisted the United States holds its contractors and government employees accountable. That's his suggestion. As well as urging the same standards for Afghanistan's government. Yeah. There'll be some accountability real soon, babe. It comes, I think the next accountability is scheduled for 5:15 this afternoon. Comes by here every day. News of AFPAC, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now...
I guess I'm just lucky so-and-so.
Well... We've built up a backlog, being distracted by other things. And so now, ladies and gentlemen, a real torrent, a tsunami of examples of the trendency, for interviewees to begin their answers to questions, not concluding anything, starting out with the word so. Not trying to wipe it out. It's here to stay. Just enjoying it, won't you? Here we go.
So you've actually developed an online calculator that shows how much an individual's data might be worth. Explain how it works.
Yeah, so what we did is... On the very basic level, most all of these companies know basic information about you.
I'm trying to get up over a dollar here. I feel like I would be a very unhealthy person.
So one of the things that really kind of changes the way that this data is valued is there's a couple of times in a person's life where they're making huge life decisions.
You write of a Senate Commerce Committee investigation which found that a list of rape victims, their information, was worth quite a bit.
Yeah, so the Senate Commerce Committee, led by Senator John Rockefeller, has conducted a series of investigations.
What was the point of the report? Why did we need to do it in the first place?
So we really didn't understand the scope of the underground commercial sex economy.
So you studied these different cities. Were there particular patterns that repeated? Any notable finds?
So as notable finds, I think, you know, two cities that really stood out as far as the size of their underground commercial sex economy was Atlanta and Seattle.
You're talking about drivers, hotel rooms, and lots of support services.
Exactly. So there is, it's almost like a small business structure.
How has the internet changed sex trafficking in the U.S.?
So the internet has essentially bifurcated the market. So before, it was primarily a street-based market.
So in all of these interviews, how did most people get into the sex trafficking business?
So at least from the pimps and the facilitator side, some common entryways was, one, generational pimping.
One of the areas that you also explored was child pornography. Tell us a little bit about that.
So we essentially, when we first received the proposed to the NIJ to study this, we considered child pornography to be part of the underground commercial sex economy.
So whether it's a Department of Justice or a local police that reads this report, what do they get out of it?
So I think that now that we have this blueprint of the entry pathways, the recruitment and all of that, I think that at least from a prevention side, we can figure out not only how to prevent the victims and other individuals from, you know, being recruited by pimps and facilitators, but also figuring out prevention strategies.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. I guess we can conclude that starting every sentence with so is goes right along with not matching the number of your nouns with the number of your verbs. Many, many things was said there that would suggest that.
Now, you looked specifically at jazz musicians. What makes them different from other musicians?
So I think jazz is known really for the unique ability of the musicians to improvise.
You actually took sort of a keyboard you concocted and brought it into a brain scanner with you?
That's exactly right. So, you know, an fMRI machine is not the most user-friendly place to play jazz.
What did you find out from the scans that you saw from those pieces playing?
So the purpose of this experiment was to really understand this idea of musical conversation. So I've long wondered when musicians are communicating with one another, they're doing it without words.
Explain that difference a little bit more for us.
Sure. So in language, we use words very specifically to have a precise meaning. So, for example, you can tell somebody in a few words to meet you for lunch at noon.
Did you see any emotion? You know, because if people love the music or like playing the music, would that part light up too?
Somewhat, yeah. So what we saw in general with these creativity studies is that when musicians start improvising, that areas of the brain that are part of the limbic system, so areas such as the amygdala that are linked to aversion, are sort of suppressed.
I have to find out how you talked somebody into letting you bring a keyboard into an fMRI machine.
Yeah, it was interesting. So literally, I would say for the first year and a half of my trying to get this thing to work, I got a lot of strange looks down at the fMRI center.
You had used rappers too, right?
That's right. So that was another study.
And so where do you go from here?
I have a lot of directions that we want to move into. So I think that there are a couple of kind of profound questions.
I guess if you say so, I'll have to pack my things and go.
That's right. Well, there'll be more. But, yeah, we can use words to be very specific, or we can use them like so and just throw them around like verbal confetti, can't we? So, ladies and gentlemen, What the Frack? What the Frack is next up here on the big show today, a feature where we look at news that affects the increasing degree to which we are hydraulically fracking our shale rock to get oil, don't you know? Dateline Bismarck, North Dakota. North Dakota will pay for the cleanup of those illegally dumped radioactive oil field waste socks we talked about here on this broadcast last week, found on the outskirts of a tiny town. According to a document obtained by the Associated Press, regulators plan to announce a contractor to clean up the site. Officials earlier this month reported the illegal dumping of hundreds of radioactive oil filter socks in a 4,000-square-foot abandoned building. Authorities have no leads on who may have left the oil filter socks in the abandoned auto shop. They say the building's owner would normally have to pay for the cleanup, but he was charged with felony larceny, and he's gone. North Dakota has faced increased problems with the illegal oil waste dumping in recent years, as it has risen to become the nation's number two oil producer behind Texas, thanks to fracking. Filter socks can be contaminated with naturally occurring radiation and are banned for disposal in North Dakota. I'd send them to South Dakota. Oil companies are supposed to haul them to approved waste facilities in other states, such as Montana, Colorado, and Idaho, which allow a higher radioactivity level in their landfills. So if you want to send high radioactivity junk around, Montana, Colorado, and Idaho would love to have it. It's doubtful anyone responsible for illegally dumping the radioactive oil field waste will be found, said the chief of North Dakota's Department of Health Environmental Health Section. It doesn't have a special fund aimed at cleaning up oil field waste. Instead, the state will be allowed to tap into another fund meant for plugging and reclaiming abandoned oil wells. And the USA's domestic energy boom is increasing demands on water supplies already under pressure from drought and growing populations. I've been kind of asking about this. Hundreds of millions of gallons of water we're using in fracking. But now here comes this new report from Ceres, a green investment group. The water-intensive process has required almost 100 billion gallons of water to drill more than 39,000 oil and shale gas wells in the U.S. since 2011. More than half of those wells were in drought-stricken areas. Nearly half were in regions under high or extremely high water stress, such as Texas, according to the report. To be in extremely high water stress means either you're being held in a CIA black site and they want to get you to confess, or it means more than 80% of the area's available surface and groundwater is already allocated for other uses. High stress means 40% to 80% of the water is already allocated. Shale development is already occurring rapidly in areas where groundwater is being depleted by other uses, including agriculture and residential development. How dare they grow food and build homes where we want to drill for oil? Nationwide, more than 36% of the 39,000 wells drilled since 2011 were in areas already experiencing groundwater depletion, according to the study. Hey, happy World Water Day yesterday, everybody. Hydraulic fracturing pumps water and chemicals at high pressure to break the shale, while fracking consumes far less water than agricultural or residential uses. The impact can be large on particular communities and is exacerbating already existing water problems, says the author of the study. Fracking is the latest party to come to the table. The demands for the water are taking regions by surprise, says the author. More work needs to be done to better manage water use given competing demands. Yeah, look how well they're handling the Colorado River these days. In Colorado, speaking of which, oil and gas development accounts for 0.1% of the state's total water demand. In Texas, it's less than 1%. A recent University of Texas report found that natural gas fracking actually saves water overall by making it easier for utilities to switch from coal to natural gas. As a result, it's helping to shield Texas from water shortages, says Katie Brown, who's with Energy in Depth, which happens to be a research arm of the Independent Petroleum Association of America. They don't have a dog in that fight. What the frack? And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. You know, the United States Navy, I'm going to stop the music for a moment because I have to give you a little background on this. I don't know if you've seen the commercials for the United States Navy. For the last few years, the slogan has been America's Navy, a global force for good. America's Navy, a global force for good. And now, the American military has poured hundreds of tons of human sewage and wastewater into a protected coral lagoon on the British-owned base of Diego Garcia over 3 decades in breach of environmental rules, as according to the British newspaper The Independent. The Indian Ocean base has been one of the world's most isolated and controversial military installations. The British government has repeatedly underlined its commitment to maintaining the pristine environment of the islands, known as the British Indian Ocean Territory. They 4 years ago were declared the world's largest marine reserve. Despite these undertakings, U.S. Navy vessels have been discharging wastewater, including treated sewage, into the clear lagoon ever since a naval support station was established there in the early 1980s. According to scientific advisors, elevated levels of nutrients caused by the waste, which have resulted in nitrogen and phosphate readings up to 4 times higher than normal, may be damaging the coral. Philippe Gregory, author and patron of the UK Support Association for the Native Population of the island, says while the people who were born and bred there are not allowed to return to their island, the military base houses about 5,000 U.S. servicemen and women. It makes no sense to suggest that Chagossians, the native population, cannot return because of pressure on the environment. Diego Garcia is one of Washington's most important strategic air and naval bases, used as a key staging point for U.S. bombing raids against Saddam Hussein and the war in Afghanistan. A force for good. The discharge practice came to light last year, but has only now become public after the Commonwealth Office of the British government deposited a written statement in Parliament. A force for good, ladies and gentlemen. And also, from outside the bubble, millions, this is actually what you could consider maybe good news. Is there room for that? Millions of homes across Britain could be heated using a carbon-free technology that draws energy from rivers and lakes in a revolutionary system that could reduce household bills, energy bills, by 20%. The Energy Secretary has described the development as, quote, game-changing in relation to Britain's need for renewable energy against the backdrop of insecurity in Russia, which supplies much of Europe's natural gas. But wait, there's more. In the first system of its kind in the UK, a heat pump in the Thames River will provide hot water for radiators, showers, and taps in nearly 150 homes and a hotel, saving 500 tons of carbon emissions from being released every year into the atmosphere. The Energy Secretary has asked officials to draw in the Cabinet Office to draw up a nationwide map showing where renewable heat can be drawn from water to explore the potential of heat pumps. In theory, any body of water, including tidal rivers as well as standing water, such as reservoirs and lakes, can be used as long as they're in the open and heated by the sun. You've heard of it. The government has a target of 4.5 million heat pumps across Britain, although some will be using heat from air as well as water. Water source heat pumps have been used on an individual domestic level, popular in Japan and Scandinavia. Why are they always ahead? Why? But have not been developed on a larger scale and have not generated sufficiently hot water for everyday use. For the first time, though, scientists at Mitsubishi and a local developer have created a system that can generate heat over 100 degrees and can be used on a wider scale for mass housing developments. The Mitsubishi EcoDan pump won the award for best new product or technology at Climate Week Awards earlier this month. It's seen as revolutionizing the renewables industry. A small amount of electricity is used to power the heat pump system, but it's supplied by a green electricity generator, which makes it technically zero carbon. So, scalable heat pumps in our future. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
My head spins. This is AC370, the search for Flight 370. Here again and again is Anderson Cooper.
Day 16, and hopefully there's no end in sight. Again tonight, we're keeping them honest, and we don't even know who they are or what they've been doing. And CNN's continuing coverage, like the search area itself, keeps expanding. Earlier this week, a familiar face returned to this network as our former space correspondent, Miles O'Brien, returned as an aviation analyst. After all, it's all flight. Now we're welcoming back another old friend, I guess I should say familiar face. No stranger to stories where information is, to put it mildly, at a premium. And taking over for the next little while, unless there's any real news, in which case Wolf Blitzer will be back. But in the meantime, here's our old friend, Larry King.
Thanks, Anderson. What a story this is. Full of twists and turns, but no road. We got a great panel here. They're going to help us go over again what we don't know, and I should fit right in, because when it comes to aviation, avionics, anything, I know from nothing. Just strap me in and give me an Ambien. In our Los Angeles studio tonight is a former FBI psychic, Rhonda Matsui. In our Atlanta headquarters is our own disaster meteorologist, Stormy Frost. And in a voiceover studio in London, a travel authority recognized worldwide, the Travelocity Gnome. Rhonda, let's start with you. What kind of cases does the FBI need a psychic for?
You'd be surprised, Larry.
Hey, if I'm awake at the end of the hour, I'd be surprised. But go ahead. Short answers are killers right now.
Well, for example, when a profiler has hit a dead end in analyzing the clues surrounding a possible perpetrator, I'll be called in, given an article of clothing, or a pen, or even a toothbrush, anything the possible perpetrator may have touched. And then I use my gift to contact the spirit of that person and to mentally question him or her.
And how many cases have you helped to solve?
That depends on what you mean by solve.
Okay, you've had a bath towel in your possession, which CNN exclusively got hold of through one of our Malaysian hotel sources. It was supposedly in the room where the co-pilot of Flight 370 may have recently stayed. What can that towel tell us?
Well, Larry, first problem, it was very recently laundered.
Oh, I bet that's the first time they had that complaint about that.
I know, but in my field, that removes about 90% of the useful psychic information.
Well, what can I tell you?
It was laundered with other towels, a very strong detergent with bleach at about 115 degrees for a good long wash cycle.
Okay, and what about the co-pilot?
I got a very weak connection with him, Larry. And so far, the only message I've gotten from him is something to the effect of someone should make sure the Mile High Club stuff is erased from the flight simulator.
Okay, Stormy Frost in our Atlanta Severe Weather Center.
Actually, Larry, I'm in the Nasty Weather Center. Severe is down the hall.
Okay, we keep hearing about storms and currents in the South Pacific. What else can you tell us, and how long can you take?
Larry, as you know, it's been from 2 to 4 days between the time satellite imagery showed something in the water to the time those images have been released. How far can that something, whatever it is, travel in 2 to 4 days? Well, as you might guess, that depends on the speed of the current and the winds, as well as their direction at that particular spot in the ocean. And, of course, 2 to 4 days later, we don't even know for sure where that spot is. Here's what we do know right now. Really bad outlook down there for the rest of the weekend. Really, if you have a choice, I'd say search in the northern arc this weekend. It's mainly sunny up there. Fair, mild temperatures in the southern arc over the South Pacific. Well, you remember the polar vortex we had last January. It's a lot like that, only without the snow.
Stormy, any link between this kind of weather and climate change?
No, Larry, this is normal weather for this part of the world at this time of year.
Okay, but normal could be caused by climate change too, right?
Let me get back to you on that.
To London and the Travelocity Gnome. You go all over the place and you never move. So that must give you a unique perspective on this puzzling mystery.
Well, not really, Larry. I'm as puzzled as the next gnome. We have no idea what happened, and we have no idea where the plane and its passengers might be.
Yeah. Tell me something we don't know. We got a question from a viewer for the gnome. Tinker Ben writes, I've been hearing a lot the last few days about Australia. What is that?
Well, it's just like a smaller America. with a big dollop of England on top of it.
And for our FBI psychic, Rhonda Mitsui, this via Twitter from BlueGene97. Is it possible that the plane could have entered another dimension, perhaps given the new theory of multiverses, even another universe? If so, how do we get it back? Rhonda.
Larry, I'm no expert, but that sounds like more than 140 characters to me.
And that makes you suspicious?
Well, it just makes me wonder if BlueGene97 knows something about Twitter that the rest of us don't.
Yeah, good point. Stormy.
Larry, just have to chime in here. Any other universe would most likely have completely different weather. So that's another huge intangible we're dealing with here.
And in that other universe, Stormy, they might not even have climate change.
No, they might not.
And the questions keep asking themselves. The answers got nothing to say. Anderson.
Thanks, Larry. Coming up in the next hour, Martin climbs into the news coverage simulator to see what our coverage would be like if a different scenario unfolds. Then something very much like this hour, but an hour later. Stay with us.
And now, news of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersole Jr. Dateline Rio de Janeiro, with IOC officials in Rio this week to monitor progress on the 2016 Olympics. The city's mayor, Eduardo Paes, acknowledged that work on a large cluster of venues is far behind schedule. Paes made his remarks as Nawal El Matawakel, the head of the inspection committee, reminded Rio officials that the recent Sochi Winter Olympics showcased, quote, meticulous planning, unquote. She urged the organizers to meet deadlines and to explain clearly to the Brazilian public why it should back the Games. Because. Sponsors. International Olympic Committee officials have criticized Rio for slow progress in preparing for the Games. Sochi's operations were a great success, but now the world's attention is turning here to Rio and to Brazil. El Mutawake said, addressing Rio organizers, a main concern is the Deodoro area, housing the second largest collection of venues. Construction has yet to begin there, with games 2.5 years away. The inspector has described deadlines for Rio as, quote, very, very tight, unquote. The IOC president, Thomas Bach, said, quote, there is not a single day to lose in Rio. Deodoro continues to be my major concern, says Pace. I'm paying close attention to it. We were given these works very late, but I'm very confident we will meet the deadlines and will deliver it, also because the construction work there is easier. The delays at Deodoro center on a dispute about what level of government was responsible for the project. The inspector from the Olympic Committee brought up Sochi several times, lauding Russians for their planning. Quote, good intentions are worthless if they're not backed by effective leadership and good governance. For the organizing committee of the Olympic Games, this is an extremely complex task with many moving parts and multiple constituencies. Sochi rose to this challenge by creating clear lines of authority and accountability. You want good governance? Go to Russia. And time may be running out for some Winter Olympic host locations, including Sochi, according to an article on current issues in tourism magazine. Two climatic indicators, minimum temperature of less than 32 degrees freezing Fahrenheit and snow depth of more than 12 inches, both from a historical point of view and using future projections in the study, finding that only 10 of the 19 previous host locations for the Winter Games will remain suitable in the 2050s. And as few as 6 in the 2080s. This will have a major impact on where and how future Winter Olympics can be staged. as the author of the study and his colleagues conclude, in a substantially warmer world, celebrating the second centennial of the Olympic Winter Games in 2124 would become increasingly challenging. Love 'em while you got 'em. The Olympics, it's a movement, and we all need one every day. News of the warm item for your listening pleasure now, ladies and gentlemen. As I hit the microphone with a piece of paper, the climate is warming in the Arctic at twice the rate of the rest of the globe, creating a longer growing season and increased plant growth, which captures carbon from the atmosphere, and thawing permafrost, which releases carbon into the atmosphere. Balance? Deal? Wash? Woods Hole Research Center assistant scientist Sue Natali and colleagues engineered first-of-a-kind warming experiments in the field to demonstrate and determine net gains or losses in carbon emissions. The study, published in the journal Ecology, found that growing season gains do not offset carbon emissions from permafrost thaw. According to Dr. Natali, our results show that while permafrost degradation increased carbon uptake during the growing season in line with decadal trends of greening tundra, warming and permafrost thaw also enhanced winter respiration, which doubled annual carbon losses. Permafrost contains 3 to 7 times the amount of carbon sequestered in tropical forests. The warming climate threatens to thaw permafrost, and maybe we'll change its name. Sometime frost. Never frost, which will result in the release of carbon dioxide and methane into the atmosphere, creating feedback loops to climate change, more warming, and greater permafrost thaw. There you go. Not a wash. News of the warm. And now, news of our friend the atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, cheap, too cheap to meet. Cheap, save, too safe to meet. Save, save, too safe to meet.
Addie?
Yeah, I didn't meet her.
I got it. Addie the atom, ladies and gentlemen. PPI shut down a reactor in the Susquehanna Steam Nuclear Power Plant in Salem Township, Pennsylvania, after discovering a steam leak this week. Workers found the leak during a startup of Susquehanna Unit 2, which had been shut off for turbine maintenance. The company tried to plug the leak but could not and shut down the unit to repair the broken valve, according to the NRC. In turning off the reactor, NRC inspectors will monitor shutdown and repair work.
Should teach him to do maintenance. Don't bother. It'll fix itself.
Unit 2 had been problematic and is under extra scrutiny from federal regulators.
How much?
I'll tell you how much. It's had 4 unplanned shutdowns since December of 2012. It is one of 6 facilities in the country in the NRC's degraded cornerstone category. Only one facility is in a lower category.
What's that, degraded tombstone?
That's 2 of them. You're good. You're a good little atom today. Dateline, Vernon, Vermont. A Vermont Yankee employee reported late last year, that security management detonated a suspicious item that resembled a pipe bomb inside the nuclear power plant compound. An official from the NRC said in a statement that the situation was not handled appropriately. An Entergy staff in Vernon, Vermont, did not follow proper procedures. The suspicious item was a length of pipe that was capped on both ends, according to a report that was submitted by an anonymous Entergy employee. Police were called to the plant, and the officer responded, turned off his portable radio and cell phones as he approached the pipe. Against the advice of the police, Entergy employees duct-taped a piece of string to the pipe, stood back, and pulled the string to see if it went off. Local law enforcement authorities were contacted. There was never a threat to employee or public safety, said a spokesman for the plant. It is our policy not to comment on security events.
That's what keeps them secure.
I guess it is. Never thought of it that way. Huh.
You should look at things more when you're spinning.
I never spin. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah.
You got more?
Oh, yes. Of course I've got more. Coming right up. You amuse yourself in the process. I will. Dateline Apollo, Pennsylvania. For many people who lived for years besides the smokestacks and dumping grounds of the area's two Cold War-era nuclear fuel factories, there's no good next step for the dangerous radioactive and chemical waste left behind. Apollo and nearby parks in Armstrong County, these are in Pennsylvania, residents have grappled for decades with the legacy of the factories operated by the Nuclear Materials and Equipment Company. Once again, the site of questions about how to handle the 44-acre property. From the late 1950s till 1983, the Apollo factory produced highly enriched uranium, and the park's facility produced plutonium to fuel commercial nuclear reactors and nuclear submarines, as well as bomb-grade material for federal government contracts.
It's all good stuff.
Waste from these operations and others was buried in a series of 10 massive unlined trenches atop an abandoned coal mine, according to regulations then in force under the now-defunct Atomic Energy Commission.
Talk to them.
Yeah. After legislation was passed in 2002 requiring cleanup, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers began excavating the site in 2012, only to stop within a few weeks after contractors uncovered larger-than-expected amounts of, quote, complex materials.
Uranium?
Check.
Plutonium?
Check. Those materials, including potentially bomb-grade material, are vastly greater in volume and potency than the Corps was led to believe by the incomplete records left behind by the company and its successors.
Somebody fooled the Corps of Engineers.
Yeah. The Inspector General's report makes clear we have substantial work to do to ensure the safe and expeditious cleanup of the site, said the gentleman in charge. I intend to urge relevant agencies to move forward immediately with a memorandum of understanding to allow the cleanup of the site. Just left some, you know, nuclear waste behind.
As you do.
As you do. And negligence was involved in all 73 incidents last year in which radioactive substances reported went missing. This concludes a new report on nuclear trafficking by the James Martin Center for Nuclear Nonproliferation Studies. It suggests there is much work yet to be done in international efforts to improve security around radiological substances that might be seized by terrorists and used to construct a so-called dirty bomb. The study examined incidents in which both atomic and non-nuclear radioactive materials went unaccounted for. Of the 153 documented incidents, 92% involved non-nuclear radioactive substances utilized in medical and industrial fields. Few incidents involved the most dangerous materials. None were reported to involve material that was nuclear weapon usable in former quality or quantity. To reduce the prospects of further incidents stemming from negligence, the report recommends
improved training.
Improve training in nuclear material security and
accountability.
Enhanced end-user accountability. You're good. You're very good.
I'm on a roll. I should be spinning. I'm on a roll. Go figure.
Our friend the atom. Clean, cheap, safe. Too out of control to meter. News of the atom, ladies and gentlemen. It is a copyrighted feature of this very broadcast. And now?
If you want me to love you, all that you must do is just say so.
Yep. We got one more, and this is a good one. So far, our examples of people beginning their sentences with so have been interviewees, journalists, and some scientists. And now it's moved up the food chain. Here is testimony this week before a congressional committee by the United States Secretary of the Air Force.
Madam Secretary, is your counsel on this?
So I do want to take a look at that, Congressman. As you said, if there's good news here, and there is some good news.
How critical is a bomber presence?
So I believe, yes, that $914 million is the right amount of funding for this year.
Is this increase in funds in the RQ-4 capability sufficient to reduce ISR gaps, especially in the Asia-Pacific region?
So I would just begin by saying everything I know about the Global Hawks, which are based in Guam, the Global Hawks in the Pacific, they're doing a great job.
Madam Secretary, will you tell us how this is affecting the Air Force negatively?
So a return to sequestration would have big consequences on readiness.
Can you do those quickly for me?
So I'm sorry, the numbers I don't have memorized.
So what is the Air Force doing to address the specialized IT and cyber acquisition needs of the force? And what are the service's long-term plans to make sure that the Air Force is in a position to rapidly assess needs and field systems to meet the new requirements?
So I'll just begin with a philosophical comment. I totally agree with you.
Can you give us your current status on where the Air Force is? Are you going to make it? And are you continuing the effort?
So I'm having regular meetings on this.
Can you give me your perspective on both affordability and sustainability for the F-35 and where we are going with that and what is being done to make sure that it is indeed cost effective and sustainable?
So I believe we're headed in the right direction. Help us understand your thinking on this and really how we can look at those changes that you're suggesting in light of other things that we might not be able to do if we don't move forward and do that. So you said it, Congresswoman, it's part of the package of the tough choices that were made. How are you kind of really working with them to have them prioritize as well what's best for them?
So I would just say, as I have done my beginnings of my tour of the Air Force and walk around workspaces, I do town halls everywhere I go and talk to airmen, the number one thing they'll bring up to me is, boy, during that period of sequestration, I couldn't get spare parts.
I'd love to have your reaction.
So I'm not familiar with that one at all.
Tell me where you believe the Air Force can benefit from shifting these components or capabilities to the Guard and Reserves like those recommended by the Commission.
So, Congressman, I want to associate myself with what you just said. In philosophy, I agree with everything you just said.
Can you say what the status of this competition is?
So there's several new entrants. We're actively trying to get them ready to compete.
Do you see it being a problem that we rely on Moscow for rocket engines?
So it is worrying, I will say that.
Yeah, she will, again and again. And by the way, good on philosophy. Now, the apologies of the week. Her philosophy is, I agree with you.
So sorry.
Deadline Jerusalem, Israel's defense minister has apologized to his U.S. counterpart for criticizing Washington for calling it weak when it comes to its stance on Iran's nuclear program. A statement from Moshe Yaalon's office said he phoned U.S. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel and told him he hadn't intended to harm relations between the two close allies. I have a very deep appreciation for the tie between the states and for you personally, Yaalon told Hagel, according to the statement. I'm fully committed to these ties and to cooperation between Israel and the United States in any form, unquote. A television news station in Omaha, Nebraska, issued an apology this week for a tweet that compared the missing Malaysia Airlines flight to the TV series Lost. ABC affiliate KETV posted a reenactment of the iconic promotional image for the long-running series, but changed the title to Flight 370. The offending tweet has since been taken down. The station has apologized. We apologize for the post. While it was not intended to be insensitive, we can see how it would be viewed that way in the light of such a tragedy, the station said in an email to the Hollywood Reporter trade publication. Rather than being able to see the faces of the actors as in the original poster for Lost, the people in the doctored image were dark silhouettes representing those who went missing on the plane. What do you think happened to Flight 370? Read the tweet with a link to the station's own website. The Daily Caller's editor-in-chief, Tucker Carlson, that's a conservative website. He's the guy who used to wear the bow tie on Crossfire. And its reporter, Patrick Howley, apologized this week for a string of offensive tweets that revealed publicly after Howley deleted them. They're offensive. Well, after Howley took down two overtly sexist tweets he wrote on Wednesday, Huffington Post alerted the caller's chief that he had taken screenshots of the tweets. They were aimed at a reporter for BuzzFeed, whose year-old article on a former Clinton advisor came under fire this week on a liberal blog. Howley deleted his Twitter account, reportedly apologized to the reporter just a couple of hours later, as did Carlson. And Michael Jordan has apologized to Tony Roten, who pivoted and spun away from the baseline and lost the sole of his shoe during a game. The 76er shooting guard said he'd received an apology from Michael Jordan, whose Nike Air Jordan 10 sneaker split apart during the ball game. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, it is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.490 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcsn.org, available for your smartphone through stitcher.com. Available as a free podcast from WWNO.org, SoundCloud, Sideshow Network, and iTunes. And it'd be just like Chairman of the House Intelligence Committee laying a quadruple negative on us. If you'd agree to join with me then, would you already? Thank you very much, Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Exile in Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead, and thanks to Jenny Lawson, distribution director for the show here at WWNO-FM. I'll see you on Twitter, at The Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy Radio Network. So long from New Orleans.